our first story, Behind Mansion Walls, bad blood destroys a dynasty.
This was a story of greed, overwhelming greed.
He wanted so bad to live a wealthy lifestyle.
And later, from high society to shallow grave.
This one is most unusual.
I've got something to tell you.
They had gates to keep the bad people out. They have security systems, but they forgot one thing. They forgot the greed that might lurk in their midst.
I'm Christopher Mason. Behind mansion walls, the rich think they're safe, but no gates or guard dogs can protect them from the enemy within.
High on a hill above Fort Worth, Texas, sits a fortress of wealth, the exclusive suburb of Westover Hills, where manicured lawns meet the fairways of Rivercrest Country Club.
Westover Hills, which is the rich area, the area that everybody who wants to be somebody aspires to live in.
These mansions are home to some of the highest paid people in America. Chief executives, property developers, and top surgeons.
With their lake-sized pools, hired help, and manicured gardens, the people of Westover Hills enjoy the fruits of financial success. But there are some who don't need to earn a living. They're the beneficiaries of a different kind of cash flow, old money. Meet the Coslows.
Jack and Karen Coslow lived in a 4,000 square foot pink mansion. Karen came from Texas royalty, solid oil money stock. Julia. Jack had a lot of money too. They were the creme de la creme of Fort Worth society.
Jack has an adopted teenage daughter from his first marriage, but she lives with her mother. So with no children at home, Jack and Karen enjoy the dream life of the rich and retired. Leisure by day, society by night.
Jack is an avid golfer. Karen enjoys flower arranging. She's also a patron of the Jewel Charity Ball and the American Cancer Society. They're both supporters of the arts, from the Fort Worth Symphony to the local ballet.
They seem to be a perfect match because he was successful, she was from a great background, and it looked like they had everything going for them.
That is until March 12th, 1992, at 3:41 a.m.
Who's there?
The Coslow's neighbor gets a surprise visit from Jack.
You gotta help.
What happened?
Call the police. My wife. Actually, we're murdered.
He was just a bloody mess. He was barely recognizable.
Police raced to the Coslow mansion. But Karen has been dead for several hours.
All right, what do we got?
Her throat is cut. A blood-stained knife on the floor beside her. Her body is covered with blunt force injuries, consistent with a crowbar. But no such weapon can be found.
There was such an enormous amount of blood all over the place.
Forensic examiner on the scene, Nazim Pirwani, is shocked by the extent of the bloodshed.
You know, I've literally done many thousands of cases, but this was an enormous amount of violence that was seen. We don't really see such extreme violence usually.
To him, the brutality suggests this is a crime of passion.
It's a lot of times the case where a spouse is murdered, that the other spouse is in fact responsible for their death.
Immediately, suspicion falls on Jack Coslow.
The police thought it curious that he had bite marks on his hands and wondered, is that what happened when he attacked his wife? He told them that he turned the alarm on, but it wasn't on and it didn't fire off. What was up with that?
Jack's accounts of that night were very sketchy. He remembered being hit. He did not remember being cut. He remembered waking up. He remembered seeing Karen dead on the floor.
Jack has been beaten and cut, but what investigators want to know is why isn't he dead too?
They also wanted to know, why did Jack wait 4 hours from the attack till the time he went to call 911?
Oh, God!
And why didn't he just call from his home? Instead, he went over to a neighbor's house.
What's even more curious? The knife that cut Karen's throat belongs to Jack.
Jack Coslow's story wasn't adding up.
Behind their mansion walls, the Coslows enjoyed the luxury of seclusion. But now, their private residence on exclusive Clark Avenue is center stage in a scandalous drama, and everyone is watching.
This is becoming one of the longer crime scene investigations in recent memory, and as police continue to piece together evidence, there are still more questions than answers.
They were kind of the talk of the town to begin with. And so when this happened, it became somewhat of a soap opera.
Reporter Jack Douglas followed the story and the gossip from the beginning.
There were all sorts of rumors going on about that they had argued the night before and that they had a rocky relationship.
Most of their acquaintances were not aware of the fact that they had gone to seek counseling.
A lot of the media speculation centered on Jack.
Relatives jumped to Jack's defense.
Hello, stranger.
First to speak out is Christy Coslow.
Hi, Karen, how are you?
Very well.
Well, that's good.
It was a big shock.
Christy actually conducted a press conference on the lawn of the house shortly after the crime was committed.
Don't think my father is capable of that. He is a wonderful person.
She said that she had no idea who could have done it, that Jack and Karen were wonderful people and that they got along great, and she couldn't have asked for a better father or stepmother.
But the media has its story.
They just want to make a fool out of me, don't you?
And runs with it.
Jack lost it. And turned on his wife and beat her to death and slashed her throat. Then when he realized what he had done, he took a knife and he cut his throat, he beat himself in the head.
Oh my God! You gotta help.
These may have been self-inflicted wounds on him to try to cover up what he did to his wife.
In Fort Worth's court of public opinion, Jack Coslow seems destined for death row. And I can tell you, when you fall from the pinnacle of privilege, it's a long way down. From king to killer, queen to corpse, the Coslows have hit rock bottom.
People were shocked when Jack Coslow came to his wife's funeral. What was he doing there? He had a lot of gall to show up there.
And it's not only the masses crowding around the gallows.
The police were very convinced of Jack's guilt. They were just waiting for the moment they were told they could go arrest him for his wife's murder. And then the phone rang.
And everything detectives thought they knew is blown away. In the gated community of Westover Hills, Texas, bad things aren't meant to happen. Just look at the crime records. The years roll by and not a single murder. But 1992 breaks the rule.
Thursday before dawn, Karen Koslow was beaten to death.
As if to balance out the quiet years, the murder of well-known heiress, Karen Koslow, is unimaginably savage.
It was overkill. She was not just murdered, she was brutalized.
Fort Worth society is appalled to discover there may be a killer in their midst. Everyone suspects the husband, Jack Koslow. He swears that two unknown attackers did the deed, but detectives think he's lying.
Then, almost 2 weeks after the murder, the cops get a phone call.
On the other end of the line was a young man telling them that he had the bloody clothes and the crowbar that were used in the murder.
I know who did the murder.
It was eating him up alive to have this knowledge of the murder of Karen Koslow and do nothing about it.
The informant's name is Paul Carrillo, a 20-year-old local of Fort Worth.
Paul Carrillo told Detective Brannon that a young man by the name of Jeff Dillingham had come to him and said, "You think you've had a bad day? I murdered somebody," and told him that he needed him to get rid of the evidence.
Paul doesn't want to get involved, but he's frightened of his former school friend, Jeffrey.
Jeffrey had been an honor student at the high school. He didn't even know the Koslows. It didn't make any sense.
Detectives can't believe what they're hearing. They haul in Jeffrey Dillingham for questioning.
Bad Bravo.
He begins to sing like a bird.
Jeff Dillingham's confession was one of the most disturbing confessions that I've ever heard in its lack of emotion. He described the death events, the killing events, in completely unemotional language.
Sammy, I will shoot you!
I had a pry ball, and I used it on the woman.
His blows to her head broke her skull and her jaw.
Bashed him up, too. But she got back up. So I came to her. And I just, jabbed her in her neck.
The final blow crushed her larynx, leaving her on the floor to suffocate to death.
Then Dillingham gives up a second attacker. His good friend, Brian Salter. Salter is just as vicious.
Take this.
To add insult to injury, after she was already gone, Brian straddled her, took a knife, and drew it across her throat.
With Salter in custody too, detectives have their murderers. But what could motivate such a cold-hearted crime?
Only two things were taken from the home. Jack's watch, as well as $120 in cash. A trivial amount from this wealthy home. It sure didn't look like robbery.
It looks like a contract killing. Did Jack give the order?
Clearly, somebody had intimate knowledge. They knew about the house. They knew the layout. They knew the alarm code.
Then, Jeffrey Dillingham drops a bombshell.
He pointed the finger at Ryan's girlfriend.
Christy Kozlov.
Christy Kozlov.
He is a wonderful person.
Jack's adopted daughter.
What's she doing here?
Christy doesn't live with her wealthy father and stepmother.
She had tried living with Jack and Karen briefly, but it just didn't work out. There was too much conflict.
What do you really want? Nothing. Can I drop by and pay my own father a visit?
Christy claimed that she and Karen were as close as any stepdaughter and stepmother could be.
Shouldn't you be at school? School's out, idiot.
Hey, don't be so rude.
But the reality of the situation was quite different. She was very resentful of her stepmother, a resentment that Karen was not showering Christy with more of her wealth.
Christy lives with her mother, Jack's ex-wife, Paula. To outside eyes, it's a comfortable middle-class home.
So unfair.
To Christy, it's an insult.
We're living in a place like this. Well,
Christy Kozlov is a rich, spoiled brat.
We deserve so much better than this, Mama.
She felt entitled to have a life of luxury.
So how does one go from spoiled teenager to cold-blooded murderer?
She had a lot of money at her disposal, but still she wanted more.
Christy does the math. Two dead millionaires equal one massive inheritance. But like so many of the spoiled brats I've encountered, Christy has no desire to do her own dirty work.
Christy was a very effective manipulator of Brian Salter. She played him like a fiddle. Brian Salter was to receive his reward by marrying Christy, and they would live happily ever after on Karen's inherited money.
Hey, that's it. That's my car.
Brian and Christy had gone so far with this fantasy of wealth that they'd actually looked at cars and houses.
This was a story of greed, overwhelming greed. They were ready to get their hands on what they thought would be about $12 million.
You need to cross the back lawn, enter the back door. This here is your alarm code.
Wasn't a whole lot of manipulation that had to be done with Jeff Dillingham. Jeff Dillingham was greedy.
How much do we get again?
$1 million. But
he was an easy convert to this plot.
The media is stunned. This time, truth is far stranger than fiction.
She did not seem the type of person that could have, number one, pulled this off, much less been the mastermind behind the whole thing.
Spend time with the wealthy, and you'll learn one thing fast. Money can do bad things to people.
We have a strong Judeo-Christian culture that tells us money is the root of all evil.
You screw it up, you get nothing.
But what it is, really, and what the Bible says, is the love of money.
That's it. That's my car.
How much do we get again?
And that is what drove them. They loved money more than they loved any person on the face of the earth.
A rousing sermon, indeed. But Christy is unmoved. She prefers romance to religion.
Christy painted herself as a modern-day Robin Hood, stealing from the rich to give to the poor.
Jack is devastated. His beloved wife, brutally slain. His own death narrowly escaped. Condemned as a murderer. And then to discover his own daughter was behind it all. For him, only revenge will do.
He was so outraged that he advocated that the prosecutors and the jury give Christy Coslow the death penalty.
The court decides Christy should have time to think about her crime. She's sentenced to life and will be eligible for parole in 2027.
Christy Coslow had a family, a fiancé, and more of life's luxuries than most. But she wanted more. The mansion, the servants, and her stepmother's jewels. What does she have now? A prison cell, an ID bracelet, and not a friend in the world. Today, at least, she knows what poverty really means.
Up next, behind mansion walls.
They're not the normal sort of people that get hurt or go missing. Where are they?
A high society couple disappears without a trace.
The whole case was bizarre.
For some, money is power.
Silence or I'll cut you off.
For others, it's poison.
The previous statement that she'd provided wasn't exactly the truth of the matter.
Oh, that's lovely.
Melbourne, Australia, April 10th, 2002.
We haven't heard from them for 6 days. We're very fearful for them.
Children of the affluent Wales family make a desperate plea.
Please, please contact the police.
Their mother and stepfather are missing.
It was very out of character for them not to be in contact.
He wouldn't go without his medication.
It's been almost a week since the wealthy couple was last seen.
They just simply disappeared.
But someone knows more than they're letting on. In the late 19th century, Melbourne, Australia was the world's richest city and the darling of the British Empire. Today, it retains certain characteristics of the mother country. The class system is one of them. The gap between rich and poor is as relevant here today as it was 100 years ago. Toorak, south of the Yarra River, is the Beverly Hills of Australia. The richest people in Melbourne live here.
They're the kind of folks who own a winter retreat in the mountains and a summer house by the sea. Big spenders who keep design boutiques and antique dealers in business. Society people like Margaret Wales King and her husband, Paul.
Margaret and Paul lived in one of our most expensive suburbs in a beautifully kept townhouse, and they drove a large silver Mercedes. They had a farm down in the Mornington Peninsula, which was also a playground for wealthy people in Melbourne.
Paul is a retired ad executive, while Margaret is a full-time heiress.
By day, you might find her at the Cattery Bridge Club or managing her stock portfolio. And her jewelry? A collection worth hundreds of thousands.
Margaret and Paul were firmly placed in the upper echelons of Melbourne society.
Margaret has five children from her first marriage. Three daughters, Emma, Prudence, and Sally. And two sons, Damien and Matthew. Every one of them has been well provided for.
The children were all involved in trusts and were able to access some form of wealth.
Margaret's late father, R.J. Lord, owned a major road construction business. The streets of Melbourne are literally paved with his legacy. When he died, he left his daughter lots of money to play with. Margaret loves to play games.
Margaret's parents had given her a lot of money, and she had interfered on the children's lives in terms of giving them money. They disagreed about an inheritance that came through the family. They'd been in the solicitor's office and they'd been fighting.
Margaret wants to invest money from the sale of a family property into her own private trust. But she needs her children's consent.
Matthew, sign, won't you, darling?
They insist their grandfather intended for them to inherit the property. The elder children make a stand.
I don't even know it's here.
Matthew was a little different. He appeared to be perhaps not of high intelligence.
Matthew was the youngest, and he was in some ways the runt of the litter. He didn't really fit in with his successful other siblings.
Now, Matthew's not going to sign.
He's not going to sign.
He was almost intellectually disabled. His IQ was 83.
No, he owns not if he knows what's good for him.
He went and became a hairdresser, and he thought that his family thought that was a bit lower class than they were.
Despite being the black sheep of the family, Matthew is his mother's favorite, her golden boy.
He was like a sweet, innocent young boy, just sweet and innocent.
Matthew's former employer, Peter Sango, recalls how Margaret always looked out for her son.
I think he was here for about a month, and then his mother came in and she said, look, if you're having difficulty keeping him employed, I will supplement his wages.
I see it often in wealthy families. Money given to one child feels like love taken from another. But does Margaret comprehend the resentment she's causing?
There was some factionalism between family members, and that became very obvious to the investigating police very quickly.
Detective Inspector Brian Ricks is a veteran investigator. He has a bad feeling about this case. When millionaires go missing, you can bet on foul play.
We have established a missing persons unit that aligns very closely with the homicide squad. And at that stage, I was in charge of the homicide squad. And we looked at this disappearance as a suspicious disappearance.
The daughters, they were calling around and they couldn't find where their mother was. She was meant to meet one of them for breakfast and she just didn't turn up. And she didn't return the phone calls. And this wasn't the sort of thing that Margaret Wales King did. So panic started and the sisters rang each other and rang their brothers and no one knew where Margaret was.
At this stage, there's not much to go on other than our suspicions. We're using traditional policing methods, door knocks, looking for people who might come forward to provide us with some information.
They took statements from every sibling about what they were doing on the night and what their partners or husbands or wives were doing on the night as well.
The couple was last seen at Matthew and his wife Maritza's house for dinner.
Should clean up a bit here, Matthew.
They said, oh, no, they were fine. We waved them off and that was it. They were happy. We had a nice night. And off they went in their silver Mercedes.
Police check Margaret and Paul's bank accounts to see if they can track their movements.
There was no movement, no purchases, no credit card usage, no petrol bought, nothing.
With no ransom demands, detectives rule out kidnapping. Then, 5 days after the disappearance, a breakthrough discovery. Margaret's silver Mercedes. wealthy couple, Margaret Wales King and her husband, Paul, have been missing for 5 days and are feared dead. Police find their abandoned car and call the eldest son, Damien, to the scene. He has the spare keys. Does he know what's in the trunk?
We looked at the car extensively, and there was some hairs and some blood spots in the car.
This case is now beyond the scope of the missing persons unit. Time to hand over to the boys from Homicide. What's their hunch? Well, consider the ingredients. Disputed inheritance, sibling rivalry, divided loyalties. You don't need to be Sherlock Holmes to figure out this is very much a family affair.
We interview all family members. I employed surveillance, listening devices, all sorts of other technologies to try and establish evidence.
Each of the Wales children is a potential suspect.
So tell me again, Matthew.
But Matthew and Maritza saw the couple last, and that puts them at the top of the list.
They interviewed Maritza separately, and she stuck to the story.
Hello.
That she got on well with her mother-in-law, that her mother-in-law had come for dinner, and then had been waved off and had a pleasant evening.
But Matthew's siblings cast doubt on their sister-in-law.
They brought a lot of pressure on her and told the media that they thought she wanted more money for a fashion shop that she'd set up, and that she wasn't happy with the way that Margaret was withholding money from the family.
To them, Maritza is nothing but a gold digger and a liar. They believe she's hiding something. To Matthew, it's just another example of his brother and sister's snobbery.
He married a woman who was from Chilean background, so migrant parents, and he thought that his sisters and his brother thought that he wasn't as good as they were.
The relationship between him and his siblings is very interesting because there is a conflict between members of the family.
Forensic psychologist Ian Joblin is intrigued by the Wales family dynamics. He believes it isn't only Matthew's siblings with a cross to bear against Maritza.
His mother didn't agree with the marriage and didn't agree with the background of Maritza.
When detectives interview Matthew...
Was Margaret on any medication?
He doesn't give much away. But police have a warrant to search the premises. And they're about to discover something this suspicious couple thought they had erased.
And they searched Matthew's house, and they found some interesting things in the garage.
How do you find blood you can't see with your own eyes? In the old days, police used bloodhounds. Today, they use luminol.
There was some spots of blood on the garage floor that the luminol showed up.
It's a big break in the case, but luminol only shows the presence of blood. It can't tell you who it belongs to.
At this stage, you must remember, we didn't have any bodies.
That is all about to change. A April 29th, 2002. In a remote forest 80 miles outside of Melbourne, a gruesome discovery is made.
Two bodies lying face down in a shallow grave, covered with a baby's pool and other material, bricks and chains and things of that nature.
There were glasses of the lady and an enormous diamond ring on her hand.
There's no doubt for detectives. These are the bodies of Margaret and Paul Wales King.
It was very clear to us from the description of clothing that they were last seen wearing.
Police returned to Matthew and Maritza's house to deepen the search. The evidence is unmistakable.
It was at that stage that the police scrutiny is becoming quite intense on Matthew and Maritza.
It's time to stop investigating and begin pressing charges. But just as detectives prepare to make their move, Maritza waves the white flag.
Maritza says, "I've got something to tell you."
Maritza has been hiding an unspeakable truth, and it's too much to bear any longer. Her husband is a murderer.
She tells them about what Matthew did and what she saw him do and what she's been living with since that night. The night that he killed his parents, Matthew Wales cooked them dinner first.
He had stolen some blood pressure tablets, blended them up and put them in their soup to make them drowsy, thinking that would make it easier to kill them.
Margaret said, "I'm feeling quite tired." Maritza went upstairs, took the little boy upstairs and put him to bed, and she went through a ritual with him of saying goodnight and singing him a song.
He escorted them out the front door. He let them go in front of him.
"Oh, I should clean up here a bit. It's all right. It's a mess.
Didn't want to make a mess inside the house, so they were killed in the front yard.
No one saw this coming, not the family, not even Matthew's own wife.
"Get back inside! Get back inside!"
Every one of them wonders, what on earth was going through Matthew's mind?
I had to. It was a relief. It's gonna be all right."
He really didn't think beyond getting rid of her. He left her in the front yard overnight, and then he dragged her and his stepfather into the garage and kept them covered up in there. Meanwhile, the family life is going round despite the fact there are two bodies in the garage.
But how could this golden boy have such a black heart?
He had an easy life. He had a charmed life, some people would think. There was plenty of money around. He'd had help from his mother, but something wasn't quite right. It was obvious he killed her, but why did he do it?
In the media frenzy surrounding the case, one word keeps popping up: money. But this is no ordinary tale of greed.
Just silent, Matthew.
This didn't happen in an emotional vacuum. It didn't happen because he wanted money.
Silent or I'll cut you off.
What he became ultimately obsessed about was the way that she used the money to get favours and to get the children to do what she wanted.
But why murder?
It was the only way that he could see himself clear of his mother's influence and perhaps gaining some financial freedom. Matthew really craved success, and he wanted to be recognised as being successful, and every turn he took, he wasn't able to achieve that.
Just silent, Matthew.
And I think his mother felt that she was protecting him when, in fact, what she was probably doing was making him resent her.
He sat down and spoke for nearly 2 hours to the police officer who was interviewing him, and he had no emotion. He spoke about it as if he were just discussing a recipe.
About the way she used money for power.
Very callous thing to do to one, your mother and your stepfather, who he'd known for many, many years.
After 3 weeks of lies, Matthew finally confesses to his crime.
So you prepared for this? Why?
Detectives are amazed at his total lack of remorse.
He really didn't feel that he'd done too much wrong. In fact, he'd solved a problem, and he felt that he'd solved a problem for other family members.
Matthew's siblings rushed to distance themselves from their brother.
They wanted the public to see that this was a fault with Matthew Wales, not a fault within the structure and the fabric of the family.
The problem with Matthew Wales was that he had a very low IQ, coupled with his obsession about his mother's use of money. And that was a very dangerous combination.
It's a cruel irony that often people with the most money least understand its power. It has the power to divide, the power to control, and the power to destroy your life. Matthew Wales is sentenced to 30 years in prison. At least inside, he has finally gained financial independence, cutting fellow prisoners' hair for the princely sum of $6 a day. Christy Coslow and Matthew Wales, two privileged children with crosses to bear. Their mansion exteriors concealed broken homes. Money was there to serve them. It ruled their lives instead. Born into this world, they were innocent, but they became the enemy within. Till next time, behind mansion walls, I'm Christopher Mason.